It's Lars. Thank you for checking out my podcast, and have a great day. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I want to do that in a moment. Have you stopped to think about the fact that we've seen a gigantic increase in attacks on police, not just here in the Pacific Northwest, but along with the rising tide of violent crime and murders? A new record has already been eclipsed in the city of Portland. I think Seattle's headed for another record as well, and records around the country when it comes to violent crime, but also attacks on police. And some of those attacks, at least by my read, are not just coming from the violent criminals. They're coming from the government. I took note of the fact that last week, the Portland Police Bureau, in this case, decided that they would end their practice of withholding the names of officers who are involved in deadly force use. And in most cases, almost all cases, use of deadly force is judged to be within the rules of the department, within the laws of the state. And I've always told you that's my standard. I back the cops as long as they stay within the laws and stay within the, you know, the practices and policies of their department. So I wanted to ask somebody about it and say, how do the cops view this? Well, Aaron Schmautz is the president of the Portland Police Association, the union for the cops in the Rose City. Aaron, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, sir. Glad to be here.
What should we make of this change in practice to say an officer involved in using deadly force or involved in an in-custody death, we're going to tell the public who this officer is? Why are they doing this, and what effect does it have on the officer?
Well, you know, the policy up until July was that we would release the name, barring any overt and named threat, within 24 hours, which is hugely impactful on officer safety. You know, these events happen. They have to talk to their family. They have to figure out, you know, am I going to be doxxed? And we've seen protesters showing up at our shootings after they happen, and we're, you know, the investigation hasn't even begun yet. We've had officers with, you know, people showing up at their homes and threatening their family, threatening their children. And so I was thankful that we put a pause on that policy while we discussed what we could do. Oregon does have public records laws, so we have to provide the information at some point, but you know, 15 days isn't as far as I was hoping we would go, but at least in this case, it provides us an opportunity to protect our members.
Okay, so you've
got
some...
This is not about transparency.
And you said, I'm sorry, Aaron, you said it's not about transparency, then what is it really about?
The moment this new policy was released, we heard several people who historically do not support law enforcement or have very strong perspectives about law enforcement said that this impacts transparency. At the end of the day, transparency is about finding out what happened, not about threatening police officers. What did the officers encounter, and what did they do? And my frustration, ultimately, is transparently, our members have been threatened as a result of their names being released. And the community, I hope, understands that all we care about is taking care of them, and then when we do things that they have questions about, doing the investigation and getting it right. So releasing officers' names quickly, that right to do so does get hampered when people who say they want transparency then turn around and threaten police officers' families.
Yeah, I'm with you, Aaron, because look, it might not surprise you, Aaron, that I like getting information out of public agencies. And usually it's like pulling teeth, even when it's stuff that is clearly releasable. They'll put up all kinds of roadblocks, not just to me, because I don't have any rights that any other citizen doesn't have. That might surprise you, but, you know, reporters don't have any special subpoena power or special power to pry loose records. But when you and frankly, if the name is released within 15 days or 30 days or a couple of months, it still allows you, if you say, we want to find out if there's a pattern that a particular officer keeps getting involved in violent incidents. It doesn't always mean the officer is wrong. The officers that are working the active districts are going to get involved in more of those incidents, right?
Correct. And, you know, and the reality is that, you know, I've heard some other people say things like, well, we want to know if the officer that we're interacting with has been involved in some incident that hasn't been investigated yet. Well, when the officers are involved in these incidents, they're placed on administrative leave as per standard practice around our country until the investigation is complete. And so, again, this is not about not investigating. We're doing that, and we do it really well. Our investigations are super open. They involve the DA's office. They involve investigators from the East County Metro team to make sure that our investigation is done, again, transparently. But we've just got to make sure that the need for information does not mean that these officers, who, again, are experiencing, just like our community, extreme violence, The origin of this change in policy was we had an event where someone tried to shoot and murder one of our officers during a domestic violence incident, and deadly force was used. And before that incident was investigated, people were showing up and threatening that officer's family. And we can't ignore the fact that our public servants do a very dangerous job, and one of those dangers should not be just pointless threats from a small group of people who have no interest in actual community safety.
See, I'm with you because, Aaron, I still remember a cop. I won't name him, but it's been years ago. He had a domestic violence. He ended up shooting a guy. The guy was about to hit his wife with an axe and probably kill her. And the woman then, you know, decided to stalk the officer, and it put him through six kinds of hell. And in the end, he ended up, you know, pretty messed up and out of policing altogether. It has all the officers are humans too. And if you think that any of the officers are cowboys who say, yeah, I put the beat down on a guy and he died in my custody, and they just go home and kick their feet up on the couch or on the coffee table, that's not how human beings react. Even if what they did was completely justified and they know it, they still are going to suffer from some anguish over being involved in the death of a human being, right?
Yeah, you know, deadly force is the most difficult decision any human would ever make, let alone law enforcement. We're placed in these circumstances, and you do the best you can. And again, we got to get it right. It's important that we do these investigations. But, you know, our officers deal with more critical incidents in a day than most humans do in their lifetime. And we have to understand that it is important that we keep them whole. They are city employees, just like anyone who works for the Water Bureau or anyone who works for any other division of the city. They're afforded due process like any other, you know, citizen in America. And, you know, we got to get past this kind of, like, you know, combative relationship with our law enforcement professionals as if they are just kind of pods. They're humans. They got families. And, I mean, look, Lars, I was doxxed years and years and years ago, and I got phone calls from people who were saying my wife's name by name, threatening to rape her when I was at work, you know, saying the name of my children's school. This is not acceptable behavior, and we have to call it out and call it what it is.
I think you're absolutely right. Aaron, I really appreciate you taking the time, and I hope that officers get treated decently, and I hope those elements of the community that want to come after them just because they're cops, that they just, you know, stop doing this. It's not helping anybody at all. That's Aaron Schmautz, who's the president of the Portland Police Association, and this is an issue essentially just about anywhere in America. Glad to be with you. In a moment, Donald Trump made a major announcement today. And no, it wasn't about something small. It was about something big involving social media and what he plans to do after he takes the oath of office in January of 2025. Interesting to hear. I'll talk about what he had to say coming up next. And you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And live on the Radio Northwest Network, we like to say we proudly serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And you're invited to join us at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we'll put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can send emails, easy to remember, talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our Twitter poll. And the Twitter poll question, well, this one actually has to do with education, which we're going to talk about next, but it's a bit different. If schools encourage Muslim students in their faith, and I'm talking not about private schools, but about the government-run, taxpayer-funded public schools. If schools encourage Muslim students in their faith, should they do the same for Christians and Jews and people of other faiths? I would answer that one yes. You can answer any way you like, at Lars Larson Show, or at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, I want to invite Lee Finna to join me. She is the director of the Center for Education at the Washington Policy Center. Lee, it's good to have you back on. And before we jump to what you and I had planned to talk about, I came up with that Twitter poll question after you and I had corresponded by email. What do you think about that, about a public school, in this case it's Kent, Washington, that says we're going to hand out Ramadan affirmation cards to encourage kids in the daily fasting that has to go on for a month? I imagine it'd be tough to be a kid and not have anything to drink or eat from sunrise to sunset. And so they want to help the kids out. And I said, okay, that's fine. Are you going to do the same for Christian kids? And my suspicion is, Leave, correct me if you think I'm wrong, that the Kent schools are saying, no, we are not going to do anything to help, help out the Christian kids or the Jewish kids. We're glad to help the Muslim kids. What do you think of that whole idea that the schools would offer up these affirmation cards to the students who are in the middle of the month of Ramadan?
It's very strange development because historically we have tried to include everyone in the public schools, recognizing that that students come from a wide variety of different backgrounds and that the government schools should not be picking and choosing one religion over another to influence the children. I mean, this is clearly a violation of the First Amendment to do this. I see this as a, I mean, like you said, if we're going to encourage students in Ramadan, then we need to start encouraging students in Christmas and Easter and then the Jews and Passover. And we should just celebrate all the religions of the world, not just
not just the holidays, but leave what I thought of this. I hope somebody in the Kent district, this is what I'd like a parent to do. I want them to print up some Ten Commandments cards. All right. And if you took those to the school and said, I'd like you to hand these out to any child who identifies as Christian, who wants one. And I assume the Muslim kids can either take the affirmation cards or not, say, okay, we're going to offer this up for the Christian kids. I can't speak for Judaism. I'm not a follower of Judaism. I respect the religion, but I'm a Christian. So if the parents, you suppose, show up at the Kent School District saying, we got a stack of Ten Commandments cards. And in fact, if the kids follow these, you know, because that's part of following their Christian faith, is to follow God's Ten Commandments, at the very least, if they haven't read the rest of the book, would the schools say, no, we're not going to do that, but we will do it for the Muslim kids?
You know, I think the schools are so confused with what they're supposed to be doing nowadays that they would do exactly that. They would support the Muslim kids and discriminate against the Christian kids. We're seeing indications of this all over the place.
Yep.
Which shows you how lost they are in the public schools.
Well, I mean, it'd be one thing, Leave, to say, we're not going to allow any faith. Okay, fine. If you're that way and say we're not going to allow any demonstrations of or affirmation of one faith or another, they're all out of the schools. It's constitutionally clean. If they say we'll recognize all faiths, and if a faith-based group says we'd like you to distribute this to the Jewish kids or the Christian kids or the Muslim kids or I guess Thai or Buddhist or any of the other faiths, fine. Go ahead and do that. You got to have all or none, though, don't you?
I think you have to have all or none of them for sure to be fair and equal to everyone and to be inclusive. Let's use those words.
Yeah.
inclusive, diverse and equitable.
Now you're talking their language, Leave. I'm talking to Leave Fenner from Washington Policy Center. Now, let's talk about the thing you and I had planned to talk about. Can it really be that in a school system like Washington's that is losing kids by the tens of thousands because parents are pulling them out, that is failing kids to a considerable degree, that is funded to the tune of billions of dollars more than they were just a few years ago, and they're still failing the kids, can it be that they're actually saying, and we're going to cut the classroom instruction time?
Yes, that's what they're talking about doing. The state Senate has passed a bill, 5054, which would cut classroom instruction time by 4 hours a week. The union has been after this for some time, and they may be getting it this go-around.
How is this justified? How are the educators, other than the union, saying, we always ask for something, so this time we're asking for this? How do they justify this on an educational basis?
Well, they always use this cover of professional learning communities. You know, we have to do professional development for the teachers so they can be taught how to teach the kids. And, of course, they that's what they're doing this go-around. That in this bill, they're saying that the state is going to pass this law, possibly, encouraging districts to provide professional learning communities for teachers and reduce classroom instruction time for kids by 4 hours a week, which is once again giving teachers a benefit, taking them away from the classroom and cutting out the child from receiving what we're spending a fortune now in public education. It's $19,000 on average statewide. That's an enormous increase over the last 10 years from about $9,000.
Now, Leave, this is where, and I know I'm going to get hated by teachers, but they say, we are professionals. Okay, there are professional doctors, and some may work for an institution that says, yeah, your continuing education, you can do that on the company's time. But most doctors who practice have to go do their CE hours on their own. Most lawyers don't get to go to a client and say, by the way, I'm going to charge you for the next, you know, 2 days while I'm at a CE, a continuing education course. You don't do that. You maintain that as part of being in a profession. Lawyers, doctors, accountants, nurses, and everyone else. And yet here teachers say, no, we want to take time away from the kids and dedicate it to keeping up our education about how to teach. That seems really thin to me. I'll give you the last 20 seconds.
Well, it's the old pupil-free days that they had in California when my kids were in school. It's the same philosophy. Take teachers out for their professional learning, but cut the time that students get with their teachers accordingly. And we already provide professional development days for teachers. Why can't they do this under that rubric? We're paying billions of dollars for that purpose already. But no, we have to cut into student instruction time. It's the pupil-free
day idea. They
would
cut it to from 30 hours of instruction per week, which is only 6 hours a day. They're going to cut it to 26 hours of instruction per week, a 13% cut for kids you're already failing. Glad you're listening on the Lars Larson Show, and glad to get your phone calls, too, at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and there's a subject I want to tell you about, but we always promise to put naysayers to the head of the line. So I'm glad to do that at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, head of the line, or first in line, 866-439-5277. Let's go first to Chuck. Hey, Chuck, welcome to the program. You're a naysayer. What do you and I disagree about today?
I just heard you a little while ago talking about that you don't like to give up the questions you're going to ask to a prospective interviewee, but yet anybody that calls you has to give up their name, where they're from, and discuss their subject matter with your people before you'll talk to them. So it seems like kind of a double standard to me.
Can I tell you why it's not?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm all ears.
When you call me, you're already saying, I want to go on the air. When I call a politician, like a senator or a governor or somebody like that, and I say, I'd like to talk to governor or representative so-and-so about whatever it happens to be, you know, solar panels, illegal aliens, whatever. In that case, the politician who both has a responsibility to respond to the public, if his handlers, and they all have handlers, tell me, well, what are you going to ask him? Give us a list of questions. And we say, no, we're not. Because he's free at the end of us giving the list of questions to say, well, if you're going to ask those things, the senator will not be coming on your program. I'm not going to give that up. That's problem number one. Problem number two is if I restrict myself to a list of 5 questions or 10 questions, then when other questions occur to me that go outside of those questions, then the senator can say, I agreed to answer only these questions. You're asking something else. And he hangs up. Now, that may tell my audience a lot. When you call the show or anybody else calls the show, do you know what the criteria are for allowing you on the air?
Yes, not to mention any other talk show and no foul language.
No foul language. We don't appreciate call. And I'll tell you why the other talk shows. Chuck, we're on radio stations all the way from Maine to Honolulu and from Fairbanks or Anchorage all the way down to Texas. And some of those stations run some of those other shows. Others, that's their competition. And it really creates problems, not for me, but for my affiliate stations. And I don't feel like creating problems for them that I don't have to. But the other thing I require of people, you have to be able to form a sentence. And like it or not, Chuck, and I'm not trying to be mean to anybody, there are people who call this show, and my producers like Dusty and Donovan and McKenzie will have somebody on the line who cannot form a coherent thought. And so you say, well, if you're going to get on and you can't even, because that's what I usually ask people, what's on your mind? I mean, that's a wide open invitation to say anything. Don't use the foul language. That gets me in trouble with the FCC, and they can fine me more money than I've ever had in my life. And they literally can and will. They can fine me up to, was it, $332,000 per radio station times about 170 radio stations. I'd be broke even if I was Elon Musk could probably afford the fine. I can't. So when people say you're screening the calls, we don't screen for age. We don't screen for, and really not even for subject matter, Chuck. I may be talking about solar panels. You call in, want to talk about illegals. I'm very wide open on that. Fridays, of course, First Amendment Fridays, we're even more wide open than that. But I'm willing to talk to anybody as long as they can form a coherent thought and they keep the F-bombs out. And I've actually had members of Congress who've dropped an F-bomb in the middle of an interview on the air. And thank goodness we have the technology to keep that from going over the air, or I'd be broke and living in a cardboard box down by the river about now. So those are the only things. But you've already agreed to come on with me when you call the show. You want to come on. If a senator said, look, I'm coming on, why don't you give me a list of questions? Chuck, as a reporter, if I'm going to tell you that I've asked the relevant questions, if you're listening to, and you clearly listen to the show, if I tell you I'm going to ask some great questions, and then I have to admit to you, but I've tied my own hands by agreeing that I'm only going to ask 5 or 10 things, and I'm not going to ask about anything else, even if it seems relevant. And having done almost 50 years of interviews in television and radio, I haven't done much. I've done a little bit of work for newspaper, very little. But if I've done all those interviews, I know that every time I do an interview, that a question will occur to me because of what the person I'm interviewing says. And I there's no way to anticipate that. So if you're talking to somebody about a particular program or some other program in Congress or in the legislature, and they mention something and say, if we do this, we'll no longer have a need for that. Well, that's going to spur a question. And if I've already agreed not to ask any questions beyond what's on the list, do you want me to tie my hands that way in an interview?
No.
And I wouldn't be honest with my audience if I said, I'm going to ask whatever I want. And we don't, there are a couple of other rules we follow, Chuck. One is, I never blindside somebody. I would never call somebody up and say, hey, we want to talk to you about the weather or the ball game, and then bring them on and then sandbag them by asking them about something else. You know, by I will always tell them the general subject matter. You know, when Donald Trump's on, I ask whatever I want to ask. We've never had to agree to a set of questions to talk to Donald Trump. When I've asked for Joe Biden interviews, never get them. I asked for 9 years to get Barack Obama. I asked both when he was a candidate and as president, never got an interview. And now it appears that the people who are asking Joe Biden questions, it appears that that LA Times reporter gave up the very question she was going to ask. Because if you look, and feel free to look, there are photos of this note card in Joe Biden's hand. You say, what's the significance of that? There's a picture of the young lady who asked him the question. There's her name and her title. There's the fact that she's going to be called on to ask a question. And then there is the question. And if you look at the question on the card and then listen to what she actually asked, it's 90%. So how did Joe Biden or his staff manage to correctly anticipate this young lady is going to stand up and ask a question, and this is what we think she's going to ask? Do you buy the LA Times saying our reporters did not give up her question? I think that's hogwash.
Well, I think I just assume because other shows do the same thing that you were doing it just to fill the questions so you could have your anti-aircraft guns ready to shoot one down.
You
didn't like.
Chuck, it's not fun. I've been doing radio for almost 50 years. I have fun every single day. I learn something every single day. I'm challenged by people every single day. And you know what, Chuck? I love it. I mean, when I get done tonight, I'm going to get some, you know, my little granddaughter, 7 years old, is over. Payson arrived a couple hours ago, and she knows that she has to wait till I'm off the air. Although she does sometimes come to the studio and hang out with me and listen on headphones and write me notes while I'm talking to somebody, usually naysayers. One time I was talking to a naysayer, and she writes this big note. She was angry because he and I were arguing. And she wrote this big no on a sheet of paper and said, tell him no. And she's holding the piece of paper up in front of me. And she's a sweetheart. She's a total sweetheart, but she is tough. But I love doing this too. I mean, I love being with I will have to admit, I hope it doesn't hurt your feelings. I love spending time with my granddaughter and my wife more than I love my job. but my job comes, right, you know, next in line. I love doing this. I wouldn't have any fun, Chuck, if we screened people out. And one of the first things I thought of when I started doing talk radio in the mid-90s, I told my producer, I said, put the naysayers on first. And she, it was a young lady then, she said, that's crazy. Nobody does that. Everybody screens them out so that everybody agrees with the host. And I said, not me. Not me. If my ideas will not stand up to a challenge, then I should go back and rethink my ideas. If I ever say, well, I've got this great idea, but don't ask me any harsh questions about it because it'll fold up like a $2 suitcase, no. I will never do business that way. I never have. And naysayers always go to the head of the line. Chuck, thanks very much. I appreciate the call. We'll be back in a moment. 866-HEY-LARS. Form a sentence. I'll talk to you. 866-HEY-LARS. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. My friend Nigel Jake was the Pulitzer Prize winning reporter from Willamette Week. I don't know if he ever gets tired of hearing that. I wouldn't if I were a Pulitzer Prize winner, but I'm glad to give him his accolades for the great stories he's done. Nigel, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Lars. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. You've written a great story about the subject of getting Portland back on track. We could easily apply the same kind of question to Seattle. What will it take to get the big cities of the Northwest back on track? And I'm wondering, I'm going to be a bit skeptical about this because I suspect that the folks in charge in both cities are not willing to take the kind of bold moves that it would take to actually move us back to somewhere closer to normal.
Well, it's a little frustrating. You know, if you remember back in 2015, our city council declared a housing emergency. And one of the many interesting statistics in today's paper is that only about 12% of the city of Portland is zoned for multifamily housing. I mean, the way you get out of a housing emergency is build a lot of additional new multifamily housing. And the fact that we haven't taken that relatively basic step, it would be very controversial. Neighborhood associations would push back, but to zone more of the city for multifamily housing is kind of astonishing to me.
Well,
so
that's
I agree.
But
I think
that
it's
assume...
going to take bold, courageous decisions by our elected officials, and we haven't seen them yet.
Sorry about that, Nigel, but does that assume that that's what people want? Because, you know, when the private sector produces products, they produce what the marketplace wants. If they don't, they end up with a lot of unsold inventory. When government makes decisions about, we'll decide what the people want, I never see that work out well. If they want to rezone some neighborhoods, the second problem with that is what happens when you go to a neighborhood that's been a single-family neighborhood, in other words, single-family homes, and you say, we're going to drop a big apartment complex in the middle of a neighborhood, and you hurt those people.
Well, you know, I think if you've been to New York, I'm sure you've been to San Francisco, you see that the development pattern in the city is that as more people come than there are single-family housing opportunities, you inevitably move to multifamily. And what we see in Portland, I mean, if there's one number that matters more than any other number in that package, it's that we have the lowest, by far the lowest, rental vacancy rate among peer cities, less than 2%. And so to me, yeah, you're right. What we should listen to what the market wants, and what that vacancy rate number shows us is the market wants a lot more rental property.
Yeah, and I would agree with you there, but then you have to be really bold, because you know what I think the cities, both Seattle and Portland, have done? They've said, hey, if you're a landlord, screw you. You can't kick tenants out for being bad tenants. You can't kick tenants out without paying a pile of money. You can't insist that they pay the rent. You can't, with no obligation on the tenants at all. Now, the vast majority of tenants are good tenants, and they pay their rent on time, and they're well-behaved. But when you put all those limits on and then say to the people who build apartment buildings, hey, would you like to come to this place? We're going to limit everything you do. We're going to tell you how to run your operation. We're going to do things that are demonstrably damaging to most of your tenants, but benefiting the worst of your tenants. Would you like to build some apartments here? I can see a lot of developers giving Portland and Seattle the big middle finger, saying, I'm not interested in building in a place like that. You've made it impossible to be a landlord.
I agree with you on that. I think that we have taken policy decisions in the last 3 or 4 years in the city of Portland that display an ignorance of basic economics. What we have is a supply problem. We don't have enough places for people to live, yet we've passed a number of policies that make it more expensive to build new housing, and we haven't passed enough policies that would provide developers incentives or make it easier for them or make it quicker or cheaper for them to build the housing that people clearly need. So you and I agree on that. I think our policy has probably been well-intentioned, but it has defeated the goal of creating the housing that the market clearly needs.
Now, I'm talking to Nigel Jaquez. WWeek.com is where you find the story. Now, you've got, as you say, a baker's dozen of 13 different ideas, and some of them are kind of radical. So let's jump out of housing. Let cops smoke weed. Will you explain that one? I understand the background to it, but I want the audience to understand why you'd say, let's let the cops smoke weed, and obviously not on duty, right?
Sure. No, not on duty. Well, a couple of things. The city of Portland has had a very difficult time attracting and retaining police officers. It's hard to recruit them. It takes 18 months to train them. A lot of the people who would like to be police officers don't pass the background check, and what we've been told is that part of the reason they don't is because a lot of people consume cannabis, marijuana, weed in some form. Now, you know, Oregon voters long ago decided that cannabis use for recreational purposes should be legal. It's the same in many ways as drinking a beer or a shot of whiskey, and cops are allowed to do both of those things when they're off duty. It makes no sense at all that we restrict the number of people who would like to be police officers by putting this artificial drug testing rule in place. You know, we changed the rule when cannabis was illegal. It made sense for cops not to be able to use it off duty. Now that it's legal, it makes no sense.
Read these Baker's dozen ideas at WWeek.com. Nigel Jaquez is the author. You'll find him at Willamette Week. Glad to be with you on a Wednesday. I'll get to your phone calls and emails in a moment. And if you ever not wondered why in some news stories, the news media can't wait to tell you the name of the bad guy, and in others, the name takes a long time to become public. Always glad that you listen to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to vote in our Twitter poll, at Lars Larson Show, or at our website, LarsLarson.com. If you want to weigh in on the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. And naysayers always go to the head of the line on the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network. We're proud to serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk, we hope, on a daily basis. And if you want to take part, that's easy. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com, and you can vote in our Twitter poll. You'll find that at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Every day a new question. Anyway, Todd Myers joins me now, Environmental Director at the Washington Policy Center, because we love to call out Jay Inslee's, I guess we can call them lies. Todd, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
So Jay Inslee, almost 4 years ago now, January 2019, said that he was going to require 50% of new state passenger vehicles, vehicles purchased by the state government for its use, 50% of them had to be electric by the year 2020 and 2021. How's Jay doing on that promise?
Well, and the irony and the reason we like to point this out is because there are mandates for the public, right? We now have a mandate that 100% of new passenger vehicles in Washington state must be electric by 2035. And so the question is, do they enforce these rules on themselves as tough as they do on everyone else? And of course, the governor puts out a lot of press releases talking about how tough he is on climate change. But when you look at the results, you don't see him actually living up to his words. And so we looked at the data, and what we found is that in 2019, the goal was 20%, and they were only at 11%. And at 2020, obviously, was the COVID year, so they were nowhere close to 50%. But now we're starting to buy cars again. So we looked at 2022, and the number was a little bit better. It was 25%, but still far short of the 50%. And for 2023, it's about 25% so far as well. So again, it is rules for everyone else, but when state government and the Inslee administration can't meet the rules that it's putting on everyone else, they just ignore them.
Well, let me ask you a theoretical question. In 2019 or 2020, if they had said, we are going to buy 50% of the vehicles that we put into the state fleet, could they have actually done it that year? Was it even possible?
It would have been very difficult and very expensive. And so this is not me complaining that they didn't meet the goal. It is showing that reality intrudes on their rhetoric. I got the data from the Washington State Department of Ecology, and they didn't buy any passenger vehicles in 2022. They did, however, buy 7 large pickup trucks. I'm not arguing that that's the wrong thing to do. That's probably the exactly right thing to do, is not to have any electric vehicles, because they need trucks and there are no electric trucks available of any, you know, sort of meaningful quality. But again, these sorts of realities don't intrude when they're enforcing the laws on everyone else. But when they have to face them, guess what? They simply ignore the rules. And it's not the first time that they have done this.
Well, and what I was thinking was, you gave them a little bit of an explanation. Well, the 2020 was the pandemic year, and we still had some of that roll into 2021. But I would almost think that when state government was largely shut down or working remotely, or, you know, circumstances had changed, you could almost argue those were better years to replace gasoline and diesel vehicles with vehicles that, you know, that ran on electricity. Because you're not walking and saying, well, we're going to swap these vehicles out for a whole different fueling system and everything else. We're going to do it while you're not busy. It's like I try to, you know, when they have to swap computers into the studio, I say, could you please do it when we're not on the air? Because swapping computers when we are on the air is really inconvenient. You'd think that those 2 years would have been great years to do all that replacement.
Yeah, that may be true. And what you're talking about is, you know, the real world. Sometimes it's better. The prices might have actually been lower because everything was shut down, but they may not have had the money that they expected. But these are practical questions that should lead the discussion. That's not how we do it, right? We set an arbitrary number. 50%, that target was not created because they did an analysis that said that 50% is doable, it's a reasonable target, any of that. They just said 50% sounds good, let's make everybody do it. That, I think, is the problem. And so I think the fundamental point you are making is that decisions should be made based on the circumstances on the ground rather than politics. But that's exactly the opposite of the way we're doing it. And it's not just bad for the taxpayers. It's bad for the environment, because we end up sort of chasing political goals rather than environmental outcomes.
Well, see, it sounds like a number that Jay Inslee just pulled out of his ear or somewhere else. And so I'm with you. I don't think they should be replacing them that way. In fact, I'd go more than that, because even though a lot of the passenger vehicles that are owned by the state are for things like children's services or the health department or, you know, Department of Corrections, they're not specialty vehicles. A lot of them aren't. Some are. And they're going to have to make exceptions for the, you know, where are you going to find an electric snowplow? Actually, I think there's a place somewhere in America that has some electric snowplows, or they looked at them and they said, yeah, but they only, I think it was New York, they only run for 4 hours. And you say, no, we need a plow that'll plow snow for 12 hours and then get refilled and plow it for another 12. And they said, no, you're not going to get that with an electric. You're going to have to go with diesel. But I think they ought to go for the greatest bang for the buck for the taxpayer. And I think electric pickup trucks, especially, I think I told you this before, just one day, just for fun, at night after dinner, I sat down and I pulled up a garden variety stripped down F-150 plain Jane gasoline vehicle, you know, gasoline Ford, and the F-150 electric, you know, the Lightning. And I said, how do they compare? Well, they're about $20,000 apart in price. And then I calculated how much gasoline you could buy for $20,000 and how many miles you could go. You can go around the planet almost 4 times if there was a road that went around the planet, you know, with the amount of gas you could buy with the price difference between the two. And you say, does that make sense to buy a pickup truck that costs so much more to run it on electricity? And by the way, the electricity isn't free either. It's cheaper in the Northwest, but it ain't free. So, you know, I think a lot of these things should not be done so Jay can, you know, Jay or anybody else, Tina Kotek, can virtue signal. I want them to do it because it makes sense for the taxpayers. And if they had to do it that way, they wouldn't be buying any electric vehicles. I'll give you the last 20 seconds.
Yeah, and I think that's the response that they would have as well, but going electric helps the planet. And the fact is, no, because you are spending a huge amount of money that could go to things that help the planet, but instead you're wasting them on excessively expensive vehicles. And that, I think, is what we have to keep in mind, is that this is not just bad for the taxpayers, it's bad for the planet, because you are spending money that yields tiny environmental benefits, but it costs a lot.
Absolutely. That's Todd Myers from Washington Policy Center. Glad you're listening on the Lawrence Larson Show. It's a pleasure to take your phone calls and emails. And as you know, we put naysayers right to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LawrenceLarson.com. Doesn't get much easier than that. And you can vote in our Twitter poll. You'll find it two places, at Lars Larson Show on Twitter and LarsLarson.com on the web. And you're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. If you want to jump in to the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Less than half a mile from where I'm standing right now is one of America's biggest rivers. It's called the Columbia River. And I always like to remind people, I've never heard anybody else say it, but I say about 2 days after that water in the river goes past where I'm standing right now, it becomes the most plentiful and useless substance on earth. It becomes salt water. And at any given moment, less than 2% of all the water on planet Earth, water we absolutely have to live, is fresh water. The other 98% plus is salt water. And so when I saw Susan Shelley's columns, she's an editorial writer for the Southern California News Group, writing about the fact that we are missing a tremendous opportunity to hang on to some of the water that falls at this time of the year so that places that are notoriously short of water, but they're only short because they don't decide to hang on to the stuff that's falling out of the sky right now. On that note, Susan Shelley joins me now. Susan, it's a real pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks so very much.
Thank you, Lars. It's great to be with you.
Well, I got to tell you something. Your columns really hit home with me because almost all the states that are short of water are only short some parts of the year. And you say, well, why don't they hang on to the water? And about a month ago, I saw a number that said that the state you live in, California, if they had merely hung on to the water that fell just in January of this year when there were some notoriously extensive rains during that time, they'd be out of drought trouble maybe for the next decade, but the state can't hang on to it, even though money's been set aside to do exactly that. Would you mind giving my audience your perspective on this?
Sure. Well, the rain that fell in January, 95% of it was flushed out to the ocean because of an environmental regulation. I believe it was an executive order that Governor Gavin Newsom signed in 2019 that said when rain fell between this date in December and this date in January, they would not run the pumps on the Delta. We have two huge water projects that were built in the 1930s and the 1960s to move water down to the farms and the cities, and they have throttled them because of lawsuits over endangered species or threatened species or just species that have lawyered up and arranged settlements for themselves. So that was the reason it was all flushed out in January. But what has just happened is our reservoirs are too full, and water was released all weekend from Lake Oroville, which is the largest storage facility in the state water project, 35,000 cubic feet per second released to the ocean. That's enough water in 8 hours to supply up to 48,000 households for a year. And they flushed it out to the ocean because there was no place to store it. And they have to lower the reservoir for flood control because it's going to rain again. And the snow is going to melt, and they can't take a chance on flooding the whole region. So they lowered the reservoir. Why don't we have water storage? In 2014, the voters of California approved nearly $3 billion to build water storage, and 9 years later, not one project has been built.
And the reason is what? More lawsuits from greenies?
Oh, the reason, it breaks my heart to say it. The reason is the language of the bond measure said that all the projects approved for this money had to have public benefits in order to qualify for the money. And the public benefits are listed as recreation, bird habitat, flood control, water quality. You know what's not considered a public benefit?
What?
Water storage.
What?
Water storage is not a public benefit. It's not a public benefit. So just providing water storage does not qualify for funding. Water storage is considered in California a private benefit, and therefore the water agencies or the local governments have to raise half the funding for the project. And 9 years later, all we have to show for what would be 6 water storage projects, all we have to show for it is a lot of environmental documentation and permitting requirements and reports to the state saying the whole thing is still on time. I kid you not. 9 years, nothing built, and they think it's on time.
Now, Susan, I'm talking to Susan Shelley. She writes columns for the Southern California News Group. So let me guess that the reason you have to dig into the language of the bill and do some interpretation is because somebody either took this to court or threatened to take it to court saying you sold this to the taxpayers as money for water storage, but now we're not allowed to spend the money on water storage because of the technical language of the bond?
Nobody even had to go to court. It was just in the fine print. I think what happened is many lawmakers did not want to build water storage because environmental activists don't like water storage. They think the whole state should be natural. And if we die, we die. That's kind of their viewpoint. And because of this political influence in Sacramento, there is a lot of pressure not to build dams, reservoirs, water infrastructure, and not to use the water infrastructure that we've already built and paid for. So it's very frustrating. They put it in the bond in order to get the votes they needed to get the thing on the ballot and get voter approval. And then they had this sort of poison pill in the language, which I don't think anyone understood at the time, that would have effectively prevented from ever being built.
Now, Susan, you live in the L.A. Basin, don't you, or somewhere near there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's where I am. I'm in Los Angeles.
If they wanted to be natural, isn't the L.A. Basin, I mean, wasn't it long before Disney, long before even the orange groves, it was naturally pretty much desert, wasn't it?
Well, I think it's technically considered a Mediterranean climate. We do get rain, but we don't get it all the time. We have dry years and we have wet years. The L.A. River used to flood. It used to be natural. And in the 1920s, it would flood and it would kill people. And in the 1930s, it would flood and it would kill people. And the Army Corps of Engineers came in after, I think it was the 1938 flood, which was particularly bad, and they channeled the river in concrete. So now when it rains, because we're a basin and the water comes down from the mountains all at once, and the river goes where it feels like going if it's not channeled. So now it's channeled in concrete. So what do you think the city government wants to do in Los Angeles? They want to jackhammer the concrete and let the river be natural. They're out of their minds. They're out of their minds. They think they're going to build apartment buildings that will be waterfront property. Don't buy anything below the 5th floor.
No kidding. Well, Susan, but if they want natural, then why don't we say, okay, we'll give the L.A. Basin natural. You'll be dry most of the time. It'll be dry and brown, and that'll be it. And then every once in a while, a giant killer flood will come along and wipe out part of the population. If that's what they want, LA's got the population. Tell Sacramento, we want to go back to killer floods and killer dry the rest of the time. You guys can be natural. The rest of us are going to be sensible. Would they go for that?
I don't know. You mentioned the Columbia River. You know, in the 1940s, we had a drought for several years. And however long it has to be for people to say, wow, we have to do something about this. And there was actually a plan that was drafted, an engineering plan, to channel some of the Columbia River down to Southern California. But then it rained and everybody forgot about it. I think that plan is still in the drawer someplace. We could look for it.
Well, we could, or the state of California could go back to the days of Pat Brown, because I remind people of that. I lived in L.A. when I was a little teeny kid. I went to kindergarten in Inglewood. But didn't he have about 25 or 30 water projects, not only on the drawing board but ready to go, until the environmentalists killed them? And you could store, those things would have stored more than enough water to carry all of California through all of the drought. You got to check out these columns by Susan Shelley from the Southern California News Group. Back in a moment, you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Always glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You know, there are some ideas out there these days that sound pretty good on their face, but you have to know the code words behind them. I mean, if somebody said to you, should we teach kids how to sort out real information from misinformation? On its face, sounds like a pretty decent idea. But when you understand the code words that are being used, maybe it's not such a good idea at all. And Ben Weingarten has written about this for Real Clear Investigations. Ben joins me now. Ben, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Lars. Always a pleasure.
Should people be worried when their schools say, we're going to teach your kids about misinformation?
Well, as you know, on its face, this all sounds great. You know, teaching kids how to critically think, to interrogate content and look at who is behind the content, who's funding it, what the slant is, who the people are that are interviewed in connection with it, et cetera. But when you dig a little bit deeper on media literacy education, which is being promoted in a growing number of states now, you see that not only is there oftentimes a progressive or hyper-political and a left-leaning direction tinge to it in the way of the academics and the politicians who are promoting this pedagogy, but if you actually look at the roots of media literacy education itself, what you find is that the organizations behind it present themselves as nonpartisan and neutral, but if you actually dig deeper in their material, it turns out it has a hugely progressive tinge, if not a Marxian tinge. In fact, when you look into media literacy, which is supposed to be about, like you said, separating fact from fiction and misinformation and the like, there's actually a discipline called critical media literacy, and it is literally critical race theory applied to looking at media. And that is promoted by most of these organizations who are behind the media literacy push. And consequently, many of the scholars who I spoke with for this report say that it's a Trojan horse for progressivism.
Yeah. And in fact, Ben, let me throw an example at you that I use all the time. People say, well, we have to fix the justice system in America because we arrest too many people of color. And I say, well, hold on. The worst crime in America is murder. What percentage of murders are committed by people of color? And the answer is about 50%. And you say, well, what percentage in black Americans predominantly and mostly male black Americans? You say, well, what percentage of America is made up of black male Americans? And that'd be 6.5% or so. You say, well, if we're arresting 6.5% of the population, 50% of the time for murder, that must mean that the system is biased against people of color. You say, or it means that 50% of the murders in America are committed by one small demographic, 6.5%. You can look at it either way, but I'm reasonably sure the left-leaning groups are going to say, no, it's just it's an indication that black males are heavily discriminated against by America's system of justice. I'd say, I think I could prove that's not true, but I'll bet that's an example of the misinformation that kids are going to be warned about. Say, don't believe these reports that violent crimes are committed predominantly by one small group of people. It's that the system is just picking on that one small group of people because of their skin color. Would that kind of example work?
Yeah, and if you look at the groups who are behind this media literacy education push, and as I did, you chronicle what happens in the conferences that they hold, the speakers they promote, and then the materials that they point to in the way of media literacy education. As I tick through in this story, you have Teach the History of Policing, a resource from the Howard Zinn, that's communist, Howard Zinn-linked Zinn Education Project. PBS's Three Ways to Teach the Insurrection at the Capitol, the Insurrection at the Capitol, Education Week's Teaching Math Through a Social Justice Lens. These fall under the guise of, and in terms of the recommended materials from media literacy advocates, these are the very materials that states that have passed these bills list as being reasonable references and resources for teachers to point to. And the broader context for this is very important. And the broader context is that we have a moral panic in this country over mis, dis, and malinformation, so-called. But oftentimes, that itself is rooted in mis, dis, and malinformation. Namely, for example, the Trump-Russia collusion narrative, which proved to be false, as well as the overblown idea that Russia interfered in the 2016 election and swung it. And then true stories that our corporate media and our betters in the kind of disinformation industrial complex said was disinformation, but which wasn't. And that's, of course, the Hunter Biden laptop story and the like. So you have to consider the context for this. And New Jersey's governor made it very clear when he said essentially that media literacy education in New Jersey is effectively about preventing the likes of the violent insurrection, as he called it, in a January 6, 2023 statement, 2 days after signing the bill. So the context is these Americans are getting mis, dis, and malinformation on a whole slew of issues from election integrity through basically anything under the sun. And consequently, we need the schools to go in and police this by arming the kids with the right information or the right worldview so as to not be duped and become potentially domestic terrorists. That's the framing that those like Governor Murphy in New Jersey have used to push these bills. And that in and of itself gives it a political tinge where even if the materials are presented as neutral and the language is neutral, those who are ultimately going to be overseeing its implementation have a political slant to them. And that obviously could play a huge role in the classroom and what kids learn.
Because, for example, right to your point about J6, January 6th, you're told Donald Trump lied and said the 2020 election was stolen. And that's a lie. That's an example of misinformation you'd be taught if you're a kid. You say, well, what about Stacey Abrams? She said her election was stolen, not just one election, but a couple of elections. You say, oh, no, Stacey Abrams, her, you know, words come out of her mouth and they're the God's honest truth. You say, hold on. So if you say anytime somebody mentions a stolen election, it's a lie, unless it happens to be a prominent Democrat, in which case it's not a lie. And this has got to be really confusing for kids, isn't it?
Well, sure. And of course, you know, teachers and librarians are authority figures. They have disproportionate sway over students. And, you know, one of the things we get to in the story is those who are skeptical of this effort note that before you get to critical thinking and grappling over these ideas, you have to have a base of knowledge, a rootedness in a set of facts, in history and beyond. And to young kids who are going to be presented now with, these are the media sources that perhaps you ought to look to, these sources lack in credibility, and here's why. There's an even more basic issue, which is, are they getting a fundamental education that you need before you can ask those sorts of questions and probe and interrogate the sources and who's behind the sources and what's the slant and the like? And, you know, one New Jersey public school teacher, longtime teacher, high school teacher, told me, essentially, media literacy, what about just literate students? And that's
read.
The real question is, do we have even basic education that we need before we get to combating mis-dis and malinformation based upon how teachers and librarians interpret it?
No, and in fact, I know that there are going to be kids who've heard the 1619 curriculum that America is an irredeemably racist country based on slavery. And they probably won't hear, for example, that long after the Civil War, or long before the Civil War, when the United States and Great Britain, you know, had a peace treaty after the War of 1812, they said part of that peace treaty is we're going to go out and send our militaries out to try to shut down slavery as a country, you know, and they won't be taught that part because it runs against the narrative. And that is, again, misinformation. You got to read this whole story by Ben Weingarten, who's with Real Clear Investigation. Ben, it's always a pleasure. Glad to get your calls next at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want you to consider that just like his stance on Israel and Taiwan, Joe Biden loves to say one thing, only to have his administration, everybody else that works for him, walk it back. But have all those walkbacks and apologies caused Americans to lose faith in Joe Biden's foreign policy? That is, I guess, of course, considering whether they had faith in it to begin with or not, given that even some of his associates from the Obama years said Joe Biden has got every single position he's ever taken on foreign policy wrong. I thought I'd talk about that with Annelle Scheline, who is with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Ms. Scheline, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So are these walkbacks costing the White House any kind of credibility it ever had?
Well, you know, what's been interesting, at least what I've been working on, is the pressure the White House put on Bernie Sanders to withdraw his Yemen War Powers resolution. That vote was supposed to come to the floor on Tuesday. And at the last minute, Sanders said he'd gotten an assurance from the White House that they were going to work on something mutually agreeable so that the U.S. would stop supporting Saudi Arabia in this war. Part of what's surprising about this is after we saw Saudi Arabia cut oil production by 2 million barrels per day in October, Biden said he wanted to rethink the U.S.-Saudi relationship and he wanted Congress to take the lead. And so this would have been Congress taking the lead. This would have been a war powers resolution to reassert congressional war-making authority. And the Biden administration issued a pretty strong statements against it, reached out to Congress, reached out both publicly and privately to say they were opposed. And so Sanders ended up temporarily withdrawing. He said he'll reintroduce it later, but, you know, it's going to be under the new Congress and it's going to be more difficult.
I want to ask you this, though. You know, administrations, they have a certain amount of information they've got to hold back about where they're going. I wouldn't expect them to tell the rest of the world where we're headed. But if you don't communicate some kind of message, overall message, this is the direction our administration is going, don't you run the risk that nobody trusts you if they don't have any idea what you plan to do and if you're constantly making changes in course that nobody anticipates?
Definitely. I mean, I think we've seen the Biden administration stick to a pretty typical playbook, just as far as the efforts to, again, try to project American power abroad. You know, we've seen them just continuing to maintain a lot of this really aggressive rhetoric towards China, something that the Trump administration started, which personally I just don't think is helpful. We really need to find ways to partner with China on important issues like pandemics and economic development, and especially on climate change. So I don't really see really that much of a difference from administration to administration. A lot of it is just sort of this notion that American primacy is the way to go, or that we're seeing one of the largest military budgets we've ever seen since, you know, some of the record-breaking budgets that were, you know, necessarily in place during times like World War II, for example. But the U.S. is not currently fighting any major wars abroad. Obviously involved in supporting Ukraine.
Well, we're sending a lot of hardware to Ukraine, aren't we?
We certainly are, but we're not, you know, we're not fighting a war the way we were in Iraq or Afghanistan, and yet still we're getting massive, massive Pentagon budgets, even above what Biden himself requested. Congress has now approved even more money, and, you know, more than half of that is going to go to private contractors and not even to the service members themselves. A report just came out that actually many military families struggle to even put food on the table, and so even though we have these massive, bloated Pentagon budgets, not actually going to support our service members. Most of it is going to, you know, massive military companies like Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, the other big five weapons contractors, who, you know, price gouge and charge far, far beyond what many of their services are actually worth. But, you know, they've created a monopoly and they're able to charge what they want, and the Pentagon just keeps going along with it.
See, I'm kind of curious about that, though, because you've had Iraq, you've had Afghanistan, and my understanding is we've diminished an awful lot of the hardware and the equipment that we have by those actions. We left billions of dollars worth of gear behind in Afghanistan. That had to hurt. Now we're sending a lot of hardware, a lot of money as well to Ukraine, that you've got to replenish all those stores, don't you, if America is going to be prepared for whatever might come, which could be a conflict with China over Taiwan. Shouldn't we have to spend a lot of money with private contractors because they're the ones who build the bombs and the bullets?
No, I mean, I really disagree. And if people are interested, I would direct them towards my colleague, Bill Hartung's work, who's much more of an expert on this. You know, my focus is the Middle East, whereas Bill can get into much more on the sort of broader question of military spending and China and Ukraine. So recommend you speak with him, Lars, next time.
Okay, I'm glad to do that. But Anel, let me ask you then about the Middle East. I don't even get a sense of a coherent policy there. Biden comes in after Trump. Trump had the Abraham Accords, which had the promise, we were told, in the fall of 20 in the 2020 election year. We had the promise of four or five more deals in the Middle East that might have brought, you know, some additional movement forward on things that had moved in many ways in decades. What is the Middle East policy of the Joe Biden administration?
I mean, like I was saying, it is kind of a continuity of many of his predecessors, you know, essentially prioritizing relationships such as with Saudi Arabia, even though, as you said, you know, Biden has really switched on that. He was on the campaign trail really saying things like we need to treat the Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, responsible
as the pariahs
for the
murder
of Khashoggi.
That's Anel Sheline, who is with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Ms. Sheline, thanks very much. I appreciate the time. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Honestly, provocative talk radio for the Pacific Northwest. And you can certainly join the conversation anytime you like at 866-HEY-LARS. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. If you're a naysayer, we'll put you first in line. If you want to disagree with me, we'll do it. We'll give you the biggest soapbox in the Pacific Northwest to send out your arguments against my craziness. and I'll just have to ask you a few questions later on. You can find the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Ted Wheeler's comments that, hey, Measure 110, the drug legalization for Oregon that made every kind of hard drug under the sun legal to possess. I said, if it's not working, as feckless Ted finally realizes, should Oregon abandon voter-approved hard drug legalization? Now, of course, in Washington state, hard drug legalization was brought about by the courts, and the legislature has not yet seen fit to restore those laws and maybe restore some order to society. One of the guys who knows that best is Representative Dan Griffey, who's a Republican from Allen, Washington. Hey, Representative Griffey, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you.
Is there any chance, before we get to the pill presses that I want to talk to you or ask you about, is there any chance that the legislature, your Democrat colleagues, are going to go along with the idea of actually restoring some hard drug laws for the state of Washington?
We have an opportunity. We did hear in the Public Safety Committee, or excuse me, the new committee, Community Safety, Justice, and Reentry Committee. Hear the bill for a full 2 hours. There were some concerns with it. I still have some concerns with it, but it's way better than what we're doing now. I believe if we fund it, we can make a difference. So there is a chance. Let's hope they move that Blake fix, and we'll see.
But even that one only takes it back to a misdemeanor, am I right?
A gross misdemeanor. So the chance you could spend up to 1 year in the big boy house, but it's something, right? We need to, you know, I think it's about saving lives, and it's about engaging with people when we can. It's also about saving our ways of life and making sure that we isolate our kids and most vulnerable from the things that they're doing. I mean, it's not going to get me to where I want to be, but it's going to be a heck of a lot closer to where I want to be, being a gross misdemeanor than nothing.
Yeah, and I know there's a chance of spending time in jail. That's assuming you had a reasonable judiciary and not a far-left judiciary, which sadly the Evergreen State has a far-left judiciary for the most part. I wanted to ask you about this, though, and it may be an issue. As you say, this may be one of the sleeper bills in the session, and it might actually get to the governor's desk. It would make pill presses in the wrong hands a Class C felony. Would you explain, because I find this fascinating, but we've talked about the issue before, why owning something that presses powder into what looks like a pill is something that is so wrong that it ought to be punished by a Class C felony conviction if somebody is caught with one of these pill presses? Why are they so very significant?
Well, it's really tragic, and it comes from a tragic story. But basically, what this can do is industrious monsters have figured out that they can easily transport powder fentanyl, the most addictive substance known to the human being, very easily into the state, and then they can press it using these pill presses into clones of, say, Percocet, Oxycontin, the ADHD medications, and even some Skittles-looking shapes. The horrible thing is our kids are getting a hold of it. The most vulnerable in our society are getting a hold of it, and industrious monsters have figured out how they can have if the people that take the pill live through the first time consuming fentanyl, which is not always the case, and most time it isn't, that they can have a ready purchasing group of people forever. It's bad because those numbers and lines and all those things that you see on your pharmaceutical drugs are there for FDA reasons. So it sets purity standards. You know that if it comes out with a certain number and a certain a couple dots and a couple lines, you can track it back to that. It has a set purity standard. The problem [S2] Right. [S1] Is these industrious monsters are cloning them. I have a very sad story that I'd like to share, but it is
please.
Your show, so I'll let you talk.
Please tell people, because this ties right into my thoughts on it, but I want to hear the story.
A dear friend of mine, Greg Yates, he actually is now the assistant chief of the organization that we came up in, and we were partners for years and years. I knew his son, Tyler, for a long time. Well, Tyler got in a motorcycle accident, and he had had for years pain control and pain management problems. Washington State is... and most states have kind of gone you know, they ignore the few percentage of the population that are still struggling with extreme pain. That's a different policy we got to deal with. So they turn to the black market. This dear kid whose life was out in front of him, Tyler Lee Yates, Greg's son, went to a local casino where his girlfriend was working to pick her up, purchased five Percocet from somebody he knew, and he took one Percocet, and the video camera shows him slowly going unconscious and then taking his last breath from one pill. The wow. reason, and that's just sad, but in Tyler's name, we've named this bill. It's not my bill, by the way. It's Mari Levitt. So anytime you can find a good Democrat that wants to combat the things you want to combat,
absolutely.
I find that we have to elevate them. And Mari and I teamed up on this bill, and the reason is if you own these devices, there's only one good reason to own it. One, you have an FDA number, and you're allowed to own it and make pure, and you follow the purity standards. Or the other is you're deceiving people into taking something that they would not be willing to take and could kill them on the first dose.
And one of the biggest problems is that these drug dealers, these monsters, as you call them, and you're right in calling them that, they say, we've got this fentanyl, it's hugely powerful. But when they mix it and say, we're going to put a certain amount in each pill, they don't have the accuracy of a real pharmaceutical company, so they may get a little extra in one pill. And the little extra ends up being the lethal overdose that you talked about with Tyler Lee Yates. And making these things illegal to possess. Nobody is going to complain about this because nobody else except drug dealers or pharma companies has a reason to own a pill press that I can think of, although I'm willing to take a naysayer call if somebody says there's some other legitimate use of pill presses. That's Representative Dan Griffey, Republican of Allen. Glad to hear he's got a Democrat on board. Glad you're listening on the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to take your phone calls and emails. And as you know, we put naysayers right to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Doesn't get much easier than that. And you can vote in our Twitter poll. You'll find it two places, at Lars Larson Show on Twitter, at LarsLarson.com on the web. And you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. It's honestly provocative talk radio for the Pacific Northwest. And you can certainly join the conversation anytime you like at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. If you're a naysayer, we'll put you first in line. If you want to disagree with me, we'll do it. We'll give you the biggest soapbox in the Pacific Northwest to send out your arguments against my craziness, and I'll just have to ask you a few questions later on. Our Twitter poll today, should Northwest governments pay people not to drive their cars to work one day a week? Do the folks in government really hate automobiles that much that they want to pay people $50 to agree not to drive their car on 8 Wednesdays? That's literally what the city of Portland is doing right now. You can find the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Yesterday, I asked you because of Ted Wheeler's comments that, hey, Measure 110, the drug legalization for Oregon that made every kind of hard drug under the sun legal to possess. I said, if it's not working, as feckless Ted finally realizes, should Oregon abandon voter-approved hard drug legalization? Now, of course, in Washington state, hard drug legalization was brought about by the courts, and the legislature has not yet seen fit to restore those laws and maybe restore some order to society. One of the guys who knows that best is Representative Dan Griffey, who's a Republican from Allen, Washington. Hey, Representative Griffey, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thank you.
Is there any chance, before we get to the pill presses that I want to talk to you or ask you about, is there any chance that the legislature, your Democrat colleagues, are going to go along with the idea of actually restoring some hard drug laws for the state of Washington?
We have an opportunity. We did hear in the Public Safety Committee, or excuse me, the new committee, Community Safety, Justice, and Reentry Committee. We did hear the bill for a full 2 hours. There were some concerns with it. I still have some concerns with it, but it's way better than what we're doing now. I believe if we fund it, we can make a difference. So there is a chance. Let's hope they move that Blake fix, and we'll see.
But even that one only takes it back to a misdemeanor, am I right?
A gross misdemeanor. So the chance you could spend up to 1 year in the big boy house, but it's something, right? We need to, you know, I think it's about saving lives, and it's about engaging with people when we can. It's also about saving our ways of life. And making sure that we isolate our kids and most vulnerable from the things that they're doing. So, yeah, I mean, it's not going to get me to where I want to be, but it's going to be a heck of a lot closer to where I want to be, being a gross misdemeanor than nothing.
Yeah, and I know there's a chance of spending time in jail. That's assuming you had a reasonable judiciary and not a far-left judiciary, which sadly the Evergreen State has a far-left judiciary for the most part. I wanted to ask you about this, though, and it may be an issue. As you say, this may be one of the sleeper bills in the session, and it might actually get to the governor's desk. It would make pill presses in the wrong hands a Class C felony. Would you explain, because I find this fascinating, but we've talked about the issue before, why owning something that presses powder into what looks like a pill is something that is so wrong that it ought to be punished by a Class C felony conviction if somebody is caught with one of these pill presses? Why are they so very significant?
Well, it's really tragic, and it comes from a tragic story. But basically, what this can do is industrious monsters have figured out that they can easily transport powder fentanyl, the most addictive substance known to the human being, very easily into the state, and then they can press it using these pill presses into clones of, say, fentanyl, Percocet, Oxycontin, the ADHD medications, and even some Skittles-looking shapes. The horrible thing is our kids are getting a hold of it. The most vulnerable in our society are getting a hold of it, and industrious monsters have figured out how they can have a if the people that take the pill live through the first time consuming fentanyl, which is not always the case, and most time it isn't, that they can have a ready purchasing group of people forever. It's bad because those numbers and lines and all those things that you see on your pharmaceutical drugs are there for FDA reasons. So it sets purity standards. You know that if it comes out with a certain number and a certain a couple dots and a couple lines, you can track it back to that. It has a set purity standard. The problem [S2] Right. [S1] Is these industrious monsters are cloning them. I have a very sad story that I'd like to share, but it is
please.
Your show, so I'll let you talk.
Please tell people, because this ties right into my thoughts on it, but I want to hear the story.
So a dear friend of mine, Greg Yates, he actually is now the assistant chief of the organization that we came up in, and we were partners for years and years. I knew his son, Tyler, for a long time. Well, Tyler got in a motorcycle accident, and he has had for years pain control and pain management problems. Washington State is, and most states have kind of gone, they ignore the few percentage of the population that are still struggling with extreme pain. That's a different policy we got to deal with. So they turned to the black market. This dear kid whose life was out in front of him, Tyler Lee Yates, Greg's son, went to a local casino where his girlfriend was working to pick her up, purchased five Percocet from somebody he knew, and he took one Percocet, and the video camera shows him slowly going unconscious and then taking his last breath from one pill. The wow. reason, and it's just sad, but in Tyler's name, we've named this bill. It's not my bill, by the way. It's Mari Levitt. So anytime you can find a good Democrat that wants to combat the things you want to combat,
absolutely.
I find that we have to elevate them. And Mari and I teamed up on this bill, and the reason is if you own these devices, there's only one good reason to own it. One, you have an FDA number, and you're allowed to own it and make pure, and you follow the purity standards. or the other is you're deceiving people into taking something that they would not be willing to take and could kill them on the first dose.
And one of the biggest problems is that these drug dealers, these monsters, as you call them, and you're right in calling them that, they say, we've got this fentanyl, it's hugely powerful. But when they mix it and say, we're going to put a certain amount in each pill, they don't have the accuracy of a real pharmaceutical company, so they may get a little extra in one pill. And the little extra ends up being the lethal overdose that you talked about with Tyler Lee Yates. And making these things illegal to possess, nobody is going to complain about this because nobody else except drug dealers or pharma companies has a reason to own a pill press that I can think of, although I'm willing to take a naysayer call if somebody says there's some other legitimate use of pill presses. That's Representative Dan Griffey, Republican of Allen. Glad to hear he's got a Democrat on board. Glad to get your calls, too, at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You heard Trump won't be indicted today. I'm going to tell you why that may be never. That's coming up next on the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Not such a pleasure to see the record increase in crime and especially violent crime in Pacific Northwest cities. Of course, Portland had set a brand new homicide record last year. Sorry, not last year, in 21. And then in 22, it actually eclipsed that record as well. The number of shootings, the number of people wounded, the number of people killed has all gone up. And I got to wondering, can a man of the cloth actually make a difference in the skyrocketing violence in the Pacific Northwest? Well, one man who does believe he can is Reverend Matt Hennessy, senior servant at the Vancouver Avenue First Baptist Church. Pastor Reverend Hennessy, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Lars, I'm good. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be with you and to be with your wonderful listening audience.
Well, I appreciate you doing it because you actually were appealing to the man upstairs when I called you today. He said, oh, my goodness, what are you doing, Lars Larson? I got a release that said that you are part of a group that put out a plan about a year ago and said, here's what we're going to do to try to address violence. And you were kind of giving yourself a report card on what have we managed to accomplish. Would you mind sharing some of that with my audience?
No, I'm happy to do that, Lars. The group is the Portland Peace Initiative, which is a part of our work with the Interfaith Peace and Action Collaborative. And that group has been meeting for 6.5 years on issues of gun violence. And we have seen, obviously, the spike. So our push this last year was to say, here are 10 things that we're looking for the city to do. We asked city council to intervene by creating an emergency declaration, by making sure that violent crime is one of their top priorities, also to invest in organizations that are trying to do their best to fight violence as well, and things of that nature. I won't go further because I know you have it, Lars, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have. I think it's a mixed review in terms of how we've done, but there's more work that needs to be done. We are still focused on making sure that we stay in this because there are too many people that are dying on the street, too many people that are injured, too many people traumatized. And Lars, my own family, has also dealt with this as well because we lost our son in May of 2021. So
I'm sorry to hear that. And you have our sympathy.
Kind of thing. Yeah.
Reverend Hennessy, see, I think there are things that people behind the pulpit could actually do about this. But to be honest with you, I don't see them doing it because I don't think the solution is going to come from leadership so much. I mean, they've already told us what they're going to do. They're going to cut the cops. They're not going to prosecute people. They want to let people out of prison. They don't want to hold people to account. They don't even want them to serve out their full prison sentences. You don't have any say in that. But part of the problem is the community, parts of the community in particular, don't seem willing to help identify the bad guys because I don't see it as gun violence. I see it as people violence. People use guns. They also use knives and blunt objects. But I want to see people behind the pulpit saying, you're going to turn these people in. And when you see people engaging in violence or you think somebody was, involved in a violent action, you need to tell the police about it. Is that message getting out from behind the pulpit?
Lars, I think that your take on that is correct. I don't think that that's happening nearly enough. I also know that in times when I have come on the scene, when a violent crime has occurred, that people are very reticent to tell the truth about what they saw. And that part is very unfortunate. It is also the case that we in the pulpit need to make this a issue, and that we need to recognize not just one thing, but several things need to happen to try to really bring down the amount of violence that we're seeing. So your take is correct. I don't think it's about, you know, cutting police or anything like that, but I definitely think, Lars, that upstream there are issues in terms of, you know, how we work together in our families about issues regarding mental health, about issues regarding how we handle conflict, about issues of how we handle community, and make sure that we make our investments, even if in using technology, to find out where the guns are, where the gunfire is. And Lars, I'm just going to tell you, I'm ready to sit down with those who are calling the shots on the street and say, it's obvious we have failed you. So talk with us about what we need to do differently, because it's pretty clear that what we have done is not enough. And those are some of the concerns I have.
Pastor Hennessy, if you saw a member of your congregation doing something that was truly evil, you'd call them out on it, wouldn't you? Maybe privately to begin with, but later on, if they didn't stop, you might call them out and say, this person has to stop doing this because it's hurting people. You'd do that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, there's no question, Lars. Not only would I do that, I would want to make sure that they get the help that they need to not do it again.
Okay, but I'm talking in this case about one elected official. The district attorney of Multnomah County keeps having the police hand him criminals or accused criminals and then saying, I'm not going to prosecute them. Should DA Mike Schmidt be called out for that?
Well, first of all, I love Mike Schmidt, and I know that he's got a difficult job. What I also recognize is that this is one piece of the problem, that when I also understand that there are a lack of public defenders to be able to help really prosecute a number of these kind of cases. And I think, as I have interpreted what D.A. Schmidt is dealing with, is he's saying, I've got one of two choices. If I can't prosecute him, what legally am I allowed to do to try to hold people to account? And my sense is that's part of what he's dealing with.
I'm not a fan of Mike Schmidt, because when he came into office in August of the riot year, he immediately announced within months he was going to not prosecute hundreds and hundreds of cases, and he didn't have a shortage of public defenders at the time. He's using that as an excuse now, and I might point out the number of cases they're filing is down by about 50%, and the funding for public defenders is up by over 50% in the last 10 years. I don't believe they're short of public defenders, but if you'd accept that as an excuse, okay, fine. The second thing is this.
Respect that. And here's the thing.
Okay, go ahead.
I just think, Lars, that we really need to convene a summit on how we're going to get out of there. One of the things that I believe is that Portland is a city that's great. I've lived here 30 years of my life, over half of my life. The fact of the matter is, we are able, when we come together across culture, across denomination, across everything, we can solve our problems. This one is one that can be solved, but we've got to work together. We can't point fingers at each other. We've got to look forward and say, what are we going to do for the future?
That's Reverend Matt Hennessy. Glad to have you with us, Reverend. They always have the best deals. And this week, my friends at Northwest Armory feature the Sig Sauer P365 pistol, the top-selling handgun in America. The Sig Sauer P365 is a micro-compact 9mm that's perfect for everyday carry, has full-size capacity. Northwest Armory has the Sig P365 two-tone model with stainless slide for just $479.99. $99. Northwest Armory also has the Sig Sauer P365X Macro. Packs a full-size 17 plus one rounds capacity into the slim profile of a P365. Northwest Armory has the P365X Macro with Romeo Zero Micro Reflex Sight in stock for $949.99. Available at both Northwest Armory locations, Milwaukee on Southeast McLaughlin, Tigard on Southwest Pacific Highway. Visit nwarmory.com and see all the SIG pistols and rifles they have in stock and order online for in-store pickup. That's nwarmory.com and tell them Lars sent you. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program our friend Rabbi Yaakov, Managing Director of the Coalition for Jewish Values, the largest rabbinic public policy organization in America. Rabbi, how are you?
I'm doing great. Good evening. Thanks for having me back.
Good evening. It's interesting that we had planned to talk to you about whether or not Jewish progressives are, you know, just ignoring the Torah and betraying their religion in order to look good on the trans issue, especially why are people of faith, your faith, not sticking to the Torah and saying this is not what we should be supporting?
This is like woke progressives throughout the left. I mean, they will lie about anything. I mean, the fact that a group came out immediately to lie about this man, woman, man, I'm still not clear which gender he or she started off with and where he or she claimed to end up. But they claim that, she had no other way to make her voice heard. She had no way to be seen. It was the fault of Republicans for blocking trans procedures for minors in the state of Tennessee, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, Jews are being beaten up in New York much more often than trans people, and I don't see Orthodox Jews going into bars with guns and shooting people. It's just, this is ridiculous. The idea that she doesn't have agency, it's somebody else's fault, that's a lie from the left. Well, yeah. Guess what? They lie about the Torah, too.
Well, and what's crazy is if you separate, because we do in this society separate a huge amount of issues, children versus adults. You want to drink booze? Go ahead. Kids? No. You want to sign a contract. If you're an adult, you can sign a contract. If you're a kid, you can't. You want to get a piercing, you want to get a suntan, you want to get a tattoo, you want to sign up and serve in the military, God bless you, but not till you're 18. And yet on this one, you really have a community of adults saying, you have to let us do this to kids? Do they not understand? That's a non-starter, or at least I hope that it's still a non-starter, with 90% of Americans saying, keep your hands off the kids. Whatever you want to do to yourself, go ahead. Do it on your own dime in your own time, but don't do it to kids. And yet, they've crossed that line as well.
Children don't have agency. We understand that in all sorts of circumstances. Actually, I have a relative who works at a applied behavioral analysis clinic where they help kids with autism. One of the kids with autism came back, and this was, we're talking about a six-year-old child, comes back out of COVID a different gender. And, you know, the thing with kids with that level of autism is we don't let them decide what they want for lunch. So how can you tell me that that kid made that decision? It's not. It's a matter of parental abuse when a kid has not even encountered. Like, they don't know what's going on yet. They don't know what it is they're going to deny themselves for the rest of their lives. I am Jazz. That poor kid is falling apart. His body never matured the way it was supposed to. And as a result, he is hurting. And he didn't know better when he was a kid. But the parents should have known better. And, you know, the piece that I wrote in Newsweek, which appeared today, is specifically about the issue of this claim by this Jewish progressives that all of this was actually found in the Torah because you find it in children in the Bible, etc. No. The Talmud talks about aberrations because Jewish law is different for men and women in several cases, and the rabbis needed to determine what to do. But it's about objective reality, not a kid's self-perception, not even an adult self-perception, bottom line.
Well, and in fact, I'm talking to Rabbi Yaakov Menken, who's Managing Director of the Coalition for Jewish Values. I read a piece, and I've been trying to get a hold of this lady. She's a psychiatrist from Canada, and she wrote the piece saying that effectively the whole trans movement and all the people making money on it and all the people making political hay on it are effectively taking advantage of autistic kids and autistic adults by saying these people will sometimes latch on to an idea. It's one of the artifacts of autism, and that when they do, they want to hang on to it, and they have a problem that they don't feel very accepted by the rest of society because of what autism does to them, and they find out, wow, if I become trans, all of a sudden I've got all these people telling me how proud they are of me and how accepted I am. And so it'd be a natural thing, but taking advantage of disabled kids, you know, so that the medical establishment, the pharma companies can make a lot of money and certain political groups can, you know, gain some political advantage seems particularly evil to me.
Well, you know, look at the, unfortunately, regulations coming out of HHS, Health and Human Services, for people on Medicare and Medicaid, like, they're going to be provided with free plastic surgery that anybody else cannot get. And in fact, there's nothing in there. What about the kid who regrets becoming trans and they want to go back? Can they get support for that? No.
Probably.
They only provide free surgery if you want to go from your natural gender and want to look like the other one.
Well, and I'm with you on that, but when I said, well, maybe they will, because Rabbi, remember all the evil things that government has done, or through the government, medical experimentation on people, on prisoners, on other people. You know, the Germans weren't the only ones who did that. We did it too. We did sterilization. We did frontal lobotomies. We did a lot of things, and we ended up being very sorry as a society for doing it later, when it didn't actually fix the problem. Rabbi Yaakov Menken from the Coalition for Jewish Values. Rabbi, it's always a pleasure, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.